right, good afternoon. We'll call the Education Finance Committee to order. And I believe, do we have a quorum present? Yeah, a quorum is present. So in your packets, members, are the meeting minutes from yesterday's committee meeting. And I'm sure you've all had a chance to thoroughly read the minutes and review it. So if so, I would entertain a motion. Let's see, Representative Anderson, would you like to move approval of the minutes?
After careful deliberation, yes, I will move.
All right. Thank you, Representative Anderson. And if seeing a Representative Anderson's motion, any discussion or questions about the minutes? If not, all in favor of approval of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. The minutes are approved. All right. And members, as we indicated yesterday, we will continue with our presentations by Mr. Strom and Ms. Johnson, our nonpartisan research and fiscal analyst. So I'm not sure who's taking the lead on the next one. We finished one of four segments yesterday.
Madam Chair, we'll spend 2 minutes reviewing the handouts that were asked for yesterday. Then Ms. Johnson will spend 30 to 45 minutes talking about the facilities piece. I'll spend a little bit of time on special ed, and then we'll go into the integration printout. Hopefully to finish up about two on our presentations to you today.
All right, very well. And again, if you would just state your names formally for the record and then proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Three things in your packet that were asked for yesterday. The first is the chart of school districts with negative fund balances. That's the chart that's in your packet. So you can see the relatively small number and declining number of school districts that have negative fund balances or are in statutory operating debt. Hit a low in 2012 of about 2% of the districts in SOD. It's up to about 2.4% now. Then other questions yesterday asked about tax base per pupil. There's two printouts. The third category or third column on each of these printouts is the one for you to look at in your free time. They're sorted from greatest to least tax base per pupil. First one's net tax capacity. In the third column, look there for net tax capacity per pupil, and you can see the relative tax base per kid for each of the districts sorted from most to least. One caveat, whenever you see a district like Princeburg on the printouts, funny things can happen. They're a district that has a long history, but long story short, they only have two kids for purposes of our school funding formula, so their tax base per pupil is a real outlier. Just ignore them, and life is easier. The second printout does exactly the same thing, but on the basis of referendum market value. And third column again there, and you can see Princeburg again makes the top of the list. Ignore them. But the Cook County School District has the largest referendum market value per pupil at about $1.3 million of tax base, market value tax base per kid, and then it goes down from there. So you can see those distributions. Those were asked for yesterday. Representative Ansel also asked for some referendum data that hopefully we'll have ready for tomorrow's hearing.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Strom. All right, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Melissa Johnson. I'm the House Fiscal Analyst, and I was going to be talking with you today about the work group recommendations that was put forth as a result of the 2013 legislation calling for a work group to study and make recommendations on reforming the existing school facilities programs in Minnesota. There was growing consensus that the condition of facilities varied widely among districts and that the tax base and the resulting tax effort because of the tax base was varying quite greatly, and also that over time the state contribution to facilities programs in the form of debt service equalization aid was eroding over the last 20 years, and that programs like the ALT facilities program, which I'll talk about in just a minute here, that are not available to all districts were creating growing facility disparities among the districts. So the work group was convened, and the participants included school business managers, facilities directors, superintendents, school board members, resident expert at the department, Tom Melcher, and they were charged with making recommendations to the legislature, and they did this last year, taking a look at funding to make sure that it's adequate, equitable, so not based on zip code or district size, and sustainable. So the results should have before you the school facilities financing work group packet, or the recommendations. But before I delve into the recommendations, I thought it'd be helpful to have a basic understanding of some of the existing facilities programs. Many of the recommendations that are referenced in the report are changes or enhancements to the existing program, so it'd be helpful to have some understanding of that. So when we think of facilities funding tools, one of the first ones we usually think of is school building bonds. When a district needs to build a new school building or do significant repairs, they'll often go to the voters for a bond referendum. And that, if they have positive approval on that, then they are able to issue what's called general obligation bonds, and then as a result, levy annually for the debt service payments on those bonds, similar to a home mortgage. So the repayment is usually over a 20 to 30 year period. And there is a debt service equalization component. However, it is very, very small. Of all debt service payments that are made this year, 97% of them come from the local property tax and 3% from debt service equalization aid. The debt levy is the second largest category of levies at $660 million annually and about $20 million in aid. So not a very big piece. So what happens as the building ages? Just like our homes, things break, our roof needs replacement, our bathroom needs remodeling. So as facilities age, there are all sorts of long-term maintenance issues that come up. And so the next set of categories that I'll talk about relate to that type of maintenance. The first one is health and safety revenue. This is used to address things like indoor air quality problems, asbestos removal, and elimination of fire hazards. This does not require voter approval, but the districts must make a report to the department for review. It has an equalized levy component, but it's very, very low, so there's minimal aid involved in health and safety. And the amount of health and safety revenue year by year varies depending on how many projects the districts are completing in any given year. So for the current year, the health and safety levy is about $58 million, and about $600,000 of that is in the form of state aid. The next facilities tool is operating capital, and this is part of the general education revenue program. It has a facilities component and an equipment component. It also has a building index or building age index, so that the older the buildings are, the more aid the district may be eligible for. It has an equalizing levy, and this one is actually at a very high level, so most districts are eligible for some state aid. There's no voter approval required on this one, and about $87 million is in the form of levy and $120 million in aid. The next one that provides some consternation is the alternative facilities program. This addresses deferred maintenance and health and safety issues for certain districts that qualify in the program. In order to qualify, there are four criteria. The first is that the district have more than 66 students in a grade. Second, that they have insufficient health and safety and operating capital authority to meet their deferred maintenance needs. The third is that they have a 10-year facility plan. And the fourth is that they have either have 1.85 million square feet and average building age of over 15 years, or 1.5 million square foot and average building age of over 35 years or more. So the first three, a lot of districts could probably gain participation, but the threshold for the square footage is a limiting factor for most districts. And as a result, the top 25 districts are the 25 largest districts in the state are the ones that are eligible currently for the alternative facilities program. I will say that there are four districts that were grandfathered in subsequent due to special legislation. So the districts that are able to participate in that can put together their 10-year facilities plan, and then they are able to then either issue alternative facilities bonds or levy on a pay-as-you-go basis, so have the authority to levy year over year.
And Ms. Johnson, if I'll have you suspend for just a minute. We do have a question from one of the members. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And regarding the alternative facilities, I know our district, Forest Lake, is just on that borderline. They meet, I think, all the requirements except for the square footage. Okay. And I know there are some districts that made that waiver. I think you mentioned waiver prior to that. Now, is that evaluated every year then, or does the school district have to make the application? How do they go about it?
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, once they qualify, they remain qualified. So every year their square footage is calculated to see if they qualify, but once they qualify on the basis of square footage, they remain qualified from then on.
Okay.
Representative Detmer?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. Please proceed, Ms. Johnson.
And then, let's see, the sticking point with this, another sticking point with the Alternative Facilities Program is that these top 25 districts are able to get this revenue without going to the voters for voter approval. And so that is a significant issue for, I just wanted to mention too that I'm speaking from an outline that is not included in your packets. There's the overall packet, and I'll reference the recommendation numbers and the page number once I get to those, but I haven't gotten to those yet. So alternative facilities revenue for FY15 was about $221 million, $20 million of which came in the form of state aid. The next program is the deferred maintenance revenue program, and this is for the districts not able to participate in the alt facilities program. It has a relatively low formula amount of $64 per pupil, and there's also a factor built in for the building age. Districts that are over 35 years old get the full amount of that aid, and districts that are newer receive a lower amount. This category does not require voter approval and does have an equalized levy component, although it is small, $26 million for the total program, $4 million of which comes in the form of state aid. Next category is capital facilities levy, or formerly referred to as a down payment levy. This does require voter approval, and its districts in the recent past have been using it for things like land acquisition or technology upgrades, things like that, and often have them for there's a 10-year limit on the authority to be able to do this. And as you can see from the title of the program, it's not equalized, and there's no state aid component, so that is a factor. There are 34 districts that do have authority, voter-approved authority, and this year for fiscal 15, $61 million is allowed in this category for those districts. I have one final one that I'll get to, and then I'll get to the recommendations, and that is the building lease levy, and this allows the districts to levy to pay rent on leased facilities, and it can be the lesser of the actual lease costs, or $212 per pupil unit. And intermediate districts, special ed co-ops, things like that are also eligible to participate in this. There is no aid component to this, and this too has about $62 million for this year. So that's a quick overview of the existing facilities programs. With that background, I think it'll help you understand the recommendations that are going to be put forth. So the first recommendation is on page 5 of the report, and that is to establish a long-term facilities maintenance revenue program. Kind of a mouthful, but it would replace the current alt facilities, deferred maintenance, and health and safety programs. It would consolidate them all into a one long-term maintenance revenue program. So the existing districts that are part of the alternative facilities program would be eligible to continue as they are now, but districts that had not traditionally been a part of the alternative facilities program, the 300-plus districts that are currently not in the program, would be phased in over a three-year period. So starting in fiscal 17, districts would receive a $300 revenue allowance times the pupil units times the age index for the school facilities, and then it would be phased up $400 in fiscal 18 and $500 allowance for fiscal 19. And then going forward from fiscal 2020, all districts throughout the state then would have the ability to sell or issue alternative facilities bonds or levy on a pay-as-you-go basis for their deferred maintenance and health and safety needs. And key component would be that there would no longer be the requirement for the non-all facilities districts to go to the voters for voter approval. The equalization factors are recommended to be greatly enhanced so that the state share of the cost of this revenue program would increase from about 8% to 28%. The cost would be phased in, as I mentioned, by fiscal 19, the cost for this recommendation would be about $149 million a year. The second recommendation on page 9 of the report is for enhanced debt service equalization aid. There are two kind of approaches that are recommendations, a two-part approach to this. The first is to reduce the threshold for debt service equalization aid for districts to be eligible for it. Currently, the state wants the local taxpayers to put forth a certain amount of tax effort before the state aid eligibility kicks in. But this recommendation would be to lower that threshold from 15.74% of ANTC down to 10%. So the districts would be eligible sooner if their tax capacity warranted. The second piece is to replace the two-tier equalization formula and have just one tier and have it equalized at 125% of the statewide average and adjusted net tax capacity. So this would allow for many more districts to qualify, moving the bar from 3% of state aid for debt service up to approximately 14.3%. One more note about the debt service equalization recommendation is that they're also recommending that the equalization factor be indexed to inflation so that over time the state aid portion stays constant and doesn't erode over time as property values increase. The third recommendation on page 10 of the report is to equalize the capital projects levy. This is the levy that allows districts to go out to the voters for specific capital needs. And the rationale behind this is that it will help to equalize the tax effort. So a $200,000 house in one area might pay significantly different amount than a $200,000 house in another area that has higher or lower tax base. So this would help to make it so the passage would not be dependent so much on the size of the tax base. The fourth recommendation is on page 10 as well, is to establish a school facilities improvement revenue program. This would replace the building lease levy and would also be expanded to additional uses, including school safety and security, remodeling of existing space, building additions for instructional purposes. This would not allow for a whole new building to be built, but for space up not to exceed 20% of the current square footage of a building. All districts, intermediate, special ed co-ops would be eligible for this revenue, and this is also recommended to be an equalized levy at 125% of ANTC. And the cost, assuming that all districts would choose to levy to the max or to participate in the program to the max, would be $120 million, $55 million coming from state aid, $65 million from local property tax. The fifth recommendation is to increase operating capital revenue allowances and index it to inflation. You're seeing a pattern there on page 11. This is, again, for facilities and equipment, and the allowances have not been increased for a number of years, and so the first piece is to increase those individual allowances. And then to the equalizing factor, although they are high right now, would be increased even further to 470% of statewide average ANTC, and would again be indexed to inflation so that the state aid share would stay constant throughout the time. And the cost for this, assuming that all districts would choose to participate, is $32 million beginning in FY17. The sixth recommendation is to enhance debt service equalization aid for districts that have unique or special needs. Examples of this include things like the natural disasters, districts that have facilities damaged due to natural disasters, districts that are in the process of consolidating with their neighboring districts, or districts that have such a low level of property wealth such that their debt service tax rate, even after equalization, exceeds 30% of their adjusted net tax capacity. So one of the levers in order to be able to address this is to significantly increase the equalizing factor, and the recommendation that the work group had floated was about a 300% of statewide average ANTC increase. And actually last session, there was legislation from a couple of districts that were interested in participating in this program, or participating in such enhanced revenue in order to be able to, the districts still need to go to their voters and have approval, but the fact that there could be more equalization aid would lower the tax impact for individual taxpayers. And that was approved as part of the of last year's legislation. Recommendation number seven, there's just two more, is to streamline the review and comment process. It's on page 13. Most districts or most projects that are facilities related do require the districts to report, make a report to the department for review and comment or to review what the districts are proposing. The recommendation is to increase the threshold for which they have to make this go through this lengthy process is from $1.2 million to $2 million, so that the bar is higher, because some of the projects nowadays are adding up quickly and they're not very complicated and not necessarily in need of significant review. So, and it would also eliminate the review and comment requirements for projects funded under the long-term revenue maintenance program. And some of these recommendations related to review and comment were incorporated into last year's omnibus bill. Final recommendation on page 14 is to address facilities needs for other non-traditional education entities. These include charters and intermediates. They have unique facilities needs. They don't have access to the same kind of capital financing necessarily as the traditional districts do. So this would, the recommendation is to allow them to participate more fully in these long-term maintenance revenue programs and have access to them. And so both the long-term maintenance and the facilities improvement program. So what is the overall cost for this comprehensive program? The overall initial modeling that was done when the report came out showed that they, starting in fiscal 19, the cost would be approximately $300 million annually, or a 23% increase in total facilities funding, and an increase in the state share of facilities funding going from 17% to roughly 33%, or about a third of the overall revenue cost or program cost.
Any questions about that overview? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Johnson, is the $300 million annually in perpetuity?
Ms. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, yes.
Ooh, thank you.
Other questions? And members, just for your information, we'll be holding a hearing on this topic at a later date, but this is just to give you an overview of the task force study that was done and their recommendations. So. All right, I think we're ready to move on then to the next segment if there's no other questions. Please proceed when you are ready, Mr. Strom.
I can get this full screen, excuse me, Madam Chair. One note as we're getting this up on the screen for you, the facilities report is on the department's website, as are some of the printouts that go along with that, so that for anyone who wants detailed copies of those, there's information on the department website. And Ms. Johnson and I are happy with all the existing programs to show you the aid and levy splits on those and sort printouts on those and show you what the options would do for each of those. So as we approach the committee hearing on those, there's a lot of data that we can make available to you if you're interested.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry about this. See if we can get this to the right size. There we are. Very good, Madam Chair. Tim Strom from House Research. The next topic we're going to spend a few minutes talking about is special education. We want to give you a quick overview of the context for it and then talk about the funding changes that happened primarily in the 2013 session that are basically we're in a transition mode this year but are first really taking effect for fiscal year 16. Much of the data in this presentation is from some PowerPoints that MDE shared with us, and we'd like to thank them for that. Special education is a mix of state law and federal law. Local school districts in Minnesota are the ones that are required to provide the special education service. They do so under the state and federal laws. There's a real intermingling of the federal and state laws. You'll hear a lot about this, particularly in the policy committee, if this is a topic for discussion this year about what could be done to perhaps conform the state law more to the federal law, but a lot of intertwining of the two systems. So school districts, when they're responding to the special ed system, paperwork issues, all these things are a combination of federal and state mandates. The eligible categories of a disability for students are defined in state law and in state rule in Minnesota. And the federal and state law requires student assessments and the formation of an individualized educational program for each child who qualifies for services. As I said before, the local school districts are ultimately the ones on the hook to provide this service. And one other point about that, the resident school district in Minnesota is ultimately the district on the hook. If a student attends another district under something like open enrollment or charter school, to the extent that that school is not entirely meeting the needs or the funding for that student, the resident district is the one on the hook in Minnesota. In terms of our special ed population, about 15% of the total school district population in Minnesota qualifies for some sort of special education services or another. This is about 130,000 students. A lot of these students receive only an hour or two of services a week, while other students may receive a full day's worth of services during the school day. The proportion of children in each of these disability categories that are established by state law have changed substantially over time, and let's take a quick look at those. This is a chart that shows the number in thousands of students on the axis here showing the number for each of these categories. The first category listed, speech impaired, is the one that probably has one of the lowest levels of hours served for the number of children in that category. Specific learning disabilities and emotional behavioral disabilities have tended to be the two big categories over the last 30 years, with the growth now in the primary growth in the third to last category, which is the autism spectrum disorders. And if we look at how these have changed over time, this next chart shows as a change in thousands of students, the category changing. You can see as you go across there, the speech needs of students, about 4,000 more there. Quite a few less in the specific learning disability category, but a great deal more in the autistic spectrum category and in the other health-related disabilities. So these 130,000 students in Minnesota are spread out amongst each of these categories, and the level of service that they require that they receive is a function of the individualized educational program adopted for each student.
Mr. Strom, if you just hold for a minute, Representative Wills, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick clarification question. On the graph here, can students be counted twice if they have multiple disabilities?
Madam Chair, Representative Wills, the count we're using right now is called an unduplicated child count. So the count that we're using is that particular count, which does not duplicate their count. But a student certainly could have more than one category of disability. But this particular count is the one they refer to as the unduplicated student count.
Representative Wills? All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Strom.
Yes.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, special education funding is driven in Minnesota by state law. There's some special education funding from the federal government, about 20% of the total, but it's primarily the state special education funding formulas that provide money for school districts. For nearly all school districts in the state, the amount of special education funding they receive is far less than their special education expenditures. This gap is sometimes referred to in Minnesota as the cross-subsidy, and the department does a nice report each year called the cross-subsidy report that documents that gap in each school district between their revenue and expenditures.
Thank you. Mr. Representative Detmer has a question. Proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we know that the cross-subsidy, but what is the responsibility of the federal government? It's a mandated program, and what is the federal government supposed to be paying towards special education?
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, when the federal government adopted its special education laws in the early 70s, the enabling legislation suggested that the federal government would pay 40% of the cost of special education services. The highest we've received in Minnesota was a few years back when we almost hit 20%. Right now, I think we're at about 17% of the cost being paid for by the federal government.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just maybe a feedback on that. That's where one of the biggest problems is right now for our school districts is not the federal government. Not if they're going to mandate something, they may should come through with the funds for our school districts and for the state. Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for raising that point, Representative Detmer. It is a significant problem for, I think, virtually all of our districts. Representative Quam, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to mention that when I was on the Zed board, the biggest thing that we had going for us was when the state had a little more flexibility, because that federal dollars are so defined that you would first go through and do what worked with the federal, you know, in their guidelines, and then the state allowed us the flexibility to cover. It's very individualized with the students and the care, and I just want to, you know, we're talking funding. It's also very important to allow enough flexibility to meet the needs of the specific special ed children instead of over defining things. And I'm sure we'll talk about it in the future.
Yeah, we will indeed. Thank you, Representative Baum. Any other questions? All right, go ahead, Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, up until the 2013-14 school year, up until last year, Minnesota's special education funding formula was basically a cost reimbursement system. A portion of the eligible expenses, primarily for essential personnel, that is teachers and aides for special ed programs, was reimbursed by the state funding formulas. So it's what was referred to as a cost-based system. The percent that was reimbursed was nowhere close to 100%. It was much more like 60% of the total cost, but intentionally set at a percentage of the employee salaries. There were small amounts in the formula for contracted services and equipment as well, but it was primarily a staff-based funding decision based on the expenditures in each district for those programs. The system that was put in place in 2013 legislative session has 2 years of transition, last year and this year, and then beginning in 2016, next school year, will be generally to the new formula. And that new formula is a mix of cost reimbursement and funding on the basis of the individual student's characteristics. And we'll go through what a few of those funding components are. Additionally, there was added money put into the special education system by these funding changes, about $40 million per year higher than it otherwise would have been had the 2013 legislature not put the additional funding in place for the program. One other funding change for a variety of reasons in the mid-90s, prohibitions were put in place on paying special education aid directly to cooperatives like the Zumbro Education District and intermediate school districts. Those prohibitions have now been removed so that the funding will be paid directly through the state to the cooperative units. Finally, another change that first began this year that's going to be significant is that in past years, remember that I said the resident district is always on the hook for the unreimbursed costs. Up through fiscal year 2014, the resident district paid for all of the unreimbursed costs. So if a student with a disability open enrolled in another district, that serving district would bill back any unfunded costs to the resident district, and the resident district would send essentially a tuition bill to the serving district of that amount. Beginning with this school year, that bill back for resident districts is limited to 90% of the unreimbursed costs. So when one school district, when a student open enrolls or a student attends a charter school, instead of getting 100% reimbursement for the serving district, they'll now have 90% reimbursement.
Right. And Representative Erickson, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, on the second bullet point, with the beginning of this next school year, special ed be paid directly to the cooperatives and the intermediates, do they then report the UFARs? Do they then have the responsibility to report that to the department, or will that flow through someone else?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, this should now, I think, flow entirely through the cooperative or the intermediates books. So I believe on the school district books that amount will not show up, whereas before you may have seen both a plus and a minus for the money coming in to the resident district and then being sent to the serving district. And I'll double check with the department on that to make sure, but I believe now that the intermediate will be, in the case of the intermediate or the cooperative, will be the one incurring the expenditure and showing the expenditure.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Strom, and maybe this is more of a question for the department, and I could certainly ask them tomorrow when they're in front of my committee. But the breakdown then, do the cooperatives now, from your understanding, report their numbers and their caseloads, et cetera, Or does that go to the district? For example, my Princeton Mille Lacs, they're part of a cooperative. How is that reported? Or is that relevant for you?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I don't know the answer to it.
Thank
That's
you.
A really good question.
We'll ask. I'll ask tomorrow. Thank you. Odosh be on notice that I'll ask that tomorrow. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. All right. Any other questions? All right. Go ahead, Mr. Strom.
So under the new formula, a part of it is because of the transitional nature. There are several floors and ceilings put on this formula, but let me briefly describe what the initial aid calculation under the new formula is. Now, under the new special education formula, the district's going to be receiving something that's at least equal to 62% of its old special ed money, 50% of the district's non-federal special education expenditures for the prior year, or 56% of the amount calculated using the new formula. And the reason for this was the department felt very strongly that the new formula was the way to go, but they wanted to make sure that districts were not caught and have significant changes in revenue because of the new formula in its first few years. So the way the pupil-driven portion is going to work now is there's going to be four categories of aid to be considered. And the first of those is going to be a category based on some census information from the district. It's going to key off the district's enrollment, its free and reduced lunch population, the combination of those two is going to be the first part of this formula. The second parts, second, third, and fourth part, then, are based on the level of the cost level that's assigned to each of the disability categories. And the amount, then, is an amount per pupil with that disability category. And those three amounts for the cost levels are $10,000, $18,000, and $27,000. And on the next page, you can see the categories of students that will be in each of those cost levels. So at that $10,400 level, that'll include children with autism spectrum disorders, those that are developmentally delayed, and severely multiply impaired students. 24% of the child count is in that level two count, and 24% of total school district special ed spending in Minnesota is in that group currently as well. Cost level three, remember, that's now $18,000 for each child in that category. That's the includes the deaf and hard of hearing as well as the emotional or behaviorally disturbed children. In that count right now, it's 14% of the total child count out of that 130,000 child count, but yet it accounts for about 23% of the cost. And then in that fourth category, $27,000 per student counted in that fourth category, which will include the developmentally cognitive mild and severe categories, the physically impaired, the visually impaired, and the deaf-blind category. Those students right now, on average, are 8% of the child count and about 20% of the cost. So the idea with the new special education formula is to go toward a system where students are counted by the style of disability or the class of disability that they have, with different levels of funding in those categories of disability. There's a continuing to be an excess cost part of the special education formula with two ways to calculate that. Essentially, the first way would say you'll get the greater of the two calculations. The first is 56% of the district's unreimbursed costs, less 7% of the district's total general education revenue. And the second is 62% of the difference between the unreimbursed old formula amount and 2.5% of the general education revenue. A lot of hocus pocus. The basic idea of this is to try and get something that doesn't change too much in the short term for that excess cost.
Representative Quam, I believe you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For clarification, because of the 90-10 change, are we talking total, which district, the provider or the home?
Mr. Strom.
Representative Quam, on the special education funding formulas on the front end, all of the costs are originally calculated at the serving district level, but then when we get to the excess cost formula, that unreimbursed cost includes any tuition amounts billed back, so it would include any 90%. So if a student from Byron, for example, is receiving services in the Rochester School District, maybe the child receives a tremendous amount of special ed services, and the cost spent in Rochester is $100,000. If the funding were $60,000, under the old formula, 40%, $40,000 would be billed back. Now 90% of the $40,000 or $36,000 would be billed back to Byron. That $36,000 then goes into this unreimbursed category for the excess cost state.
Representative Huang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The not intuitive portion would be the 7% of the general revenue. And is that a 90-10 component combination, or if you can clarify that, less than obvious?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, I'd have to speak with the department about how they arrived at that number. I don't think it's obvious. I think it was intended to match, relatively speaking, the level that we're currently at with the excess cost. And I'll double-check that with the department, but I don't think it's tied to the 90-10.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, in addition to these excess costs, then the next thing that that is part of the new formula, and again, it's really part of a transitional part of this formula. The first part is the aid guarantees or the aid grandfathers, and districts are essentially guaranteed as much money under the new formula as they would have gotten in the old formula, and then that amount grows by 4.6% per year. So there's sort of an absolute guarantee that no district is worse off because of the change in the formula. But then at the top end as well, there's also a growth limit. And for fiscal year 16, the first year this new formula will be in place, that overall growth limit says no district should benefit by more than $80 more than they would have received on the other formula. And then for each, in fiscal year 17, the total's $100 more than the 16 level. And then for each year thereafter, $40 per year. On a per-student growth in that. So the goal is essentially to have a floor as well as a ceiling, with the redistribution taking a little bit of time, but basically ensuring no district is worse off and that no growth is exceptionally large. Madam Chair, we mentioned earlier the cross-subsidy, the difference between the special education expenditures and the revenue. This is a chart that shows on the top line, the blue line, not adjusted for inflation, what the cross-subsidy is on a per-pupil basis on a statewide level from fiscal year 2003 on. You can see for fiscal year 17, if no changes are made to the system, we're expecting that cross-subsidy to be about $758. So that's really saying that for once a little bit of general education aid is accounted for, school districts' difference between revenue and expenditures for special education purposes on average is about a $750 shortfall. There's two inflation adjustments on here. The CPI is in red, and using the implicit price deflator adjustment shows that same amount adjusted for inflation using that inflation factor. I refuse to be drawn into the wars about which is the right inflation factor to use, and you can see them both and fight those out amongst yourselves or elsewhere.
Thank you, Mr. Shum. I do appreciate you putting both of them on there, and we will let you off the hook on debating that at the moment. So Mr. Shum, so I'm making sure I'm looking at this correctly. So, in other words, the cross-subsidization has grown up dramatically, more so than inflation, no matter which factor you're going to use.
Madam Chair, if you're measuring from 2003, yes. If you look at the chart, the inflation peak was between 2006 and 2007 on an inflation-adjusted basis before the state put a fair amount of additional money into the special ed system, and we're not close to that level yet on an inflation-adjusted basis. But certainly you can see the trend there, although you can see that that's leveled off on an inflation basis over the last several years. That's leveled off, and the predicted level under the new formula is to stay relatively flat as well for the next 2 years.
Right. So then I would conclude from this that it's not an inflation issue as much as the number of students requiring special ed services growing is leading to the demand.
And Madam Chair, the cost of providing special education services, the rate of growth in that cost has slowed way down in the last few years as well. And it's not 100% apparent to me why that's the case, since the old formula was essentially looking at a cost basis, you know, the overall level of teachers. If you had teachers with 30 years of experience providing that service versus an average workforce with 10 years of experience, you'd obviously have some difference there. But just to, like with other medical costs, I think the special education costs, the growth rate has slowed way down in the last few years.
Thank you. All right.
Madam Chair, the next just shows that cost subsidy is a percent of the basic revenue formula allowance. And again, that cross subsidy report the department puts out is really handy. It's got individual district detail, and when we get to this topic in the committee, we'll distribute that report, and it's available on the department website as well. And then finally, one of the issues that we face in Minnesota, regardless of what funding formula we use, is those cross subsidies vary quite a bit by kind of district. And if you group districts into a couple of different strata, for each set of districts here, the spending, the revenue, and then the cross subsidy, which should add back up to the spending level, are shown for the different categories of district. And you can see that the highest differential is for the Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts on the cross subsidy. And then the, not surprisingly, the regional centers have the second highest level of spending, followed not far thereafter by the suburban districts. But you can see that there's really quite a bit of variation by type of district. And what we find particularly is that districts that are regional service centers in greater Minnesota, and I guess that's in the non-metro greater than 2,000 students count, will have a very different profile often. So a district like St. Cloud, for example, will have a very different special education profile, much higher cross-subsidy than surrounding districts. But it's important to note that cross-subsidy, while it averages the $758 per pupil, varies quite a bit amongst districts. And Madam Chair, that's, I think, what we were going to talk about on special education today.
All right. I don't see any questions or anyone with their hand up, so we'll go ahead and move on to the next on operating referendum.
Madam Chair, we're speaking to the integration.
Oh.
That was the last piece.
We
talked about the referendum yesterday.
Oh, yeah, you're right. You're right. Thank you
that's
very
okay.
much.
That's okay. You should have a handout in your packet for, thank you, Madam Chair. That titled FY15 Achievement and Integration Revenue. This is a spreadsheet that was originally placed on the department's website to show what the estimated revenue distribution is for the integration and revenue program. I wanted to back up briefly, though, and talk about the program itself. It has been changed significantly in the last couple of years, but the program had been in place prior for a number of years, and the original stated purpose was to promote racial and economic integration within and among school districts. So it was an aid and levy program, 70% aid and 30% levy. And then in 2011, the legislature put in place a repeal and replacement of the existing program, both the formula and, you know, the requirements and that type of thing. So that was a working group was established to look at the program comprehensively and make recommendations to the legislature. And they did report back in the 2012 session. And then in fiscal, or in the 2013 legislative session, the committee enacted on a new achievement and integration revenue program that they called AIM, Achievement and Integration for Minnesota. And that is reflected here on this spreadsheet. Before I get into the funding changes, I also want to focus on that there's a newfound focus or additional focus on addressing the achievement gap as a part of this revenue and having the funding tied to meeting those strategic goals. There's also a public annual meeting requirement to brief the public on progress in meeting those goals. And there's a three-year budget cycle that the districts have to report their goals and budget and have them reviewed by the department. The district does have authority to withhold a portion of the revenue if they determine that the district isn't meeting their identified goals, but that has not been in place yet, or we've not met that threshold yet. So if you take a look at the spreadsheet, we thought it'd be helpful to look at how the revenue distribution changed under the new formula versus the old formula. So the first column shows for FY13. This program was actually implemented beginning for FY14. But the data we have here is for FY13. You can see that the statewide total revenue, which included the aid and levy components, was about $91.5 million. And you can see the distribution of how that was distributed. The next two columns show the variables that play into the formula and help determine the funding levels. And so for FY15, we have the pupil counts of 862,000. And then the next column is the percentage students of color. So it gives you a sense of how large the districts are and what percentage students of color reside in the district. The next column is FY15 revenue, and you can see that the revenue went down just slightly to $88.8 million distributed. This is inclusive of there's two components of the new revenue formula. There's a $350 per pupil times the percentage of students of color within the district. And so that's inclusive of that. And then there's also a $10 per pupil incentive revenue for districts that agreed to do additional work in that area. So we thought it would be helpful to compare on a before and after basis how funding has been redistributed. You'll see, for example, on line 2, 1.2, Minneapolis had been receiving about $475 per pupil, and now they're receiving about $402. A district like Columbia Heights on district number 13 had been receiving about $184 per pupil and now is receiving about $252 per pupil. So that just kind of gives you an idea of the breakdown. There are 130 districts currently participating in this program.
Any questions? And I'm sure we'll have discussions about this as well. In my tenure in the legislature, we've had how many task forces? I'm looking at Representative Newton because I know you headed one up.
I think at the second.
Yes. There's been several. So this is an ongoing discussion. But at least gives you a snapshot of where we're at right now and what the districts are receiving. So, any other questions from the committee members on the presentations? All right. And again, as always, our excellent nonpartisan research staff and fiscal analysts are always available to answer your questions. So please avail yourself of that excellent resource. So. All right. Well, with that, we had announced that if time permitted, we would go ahead and open up for testimony from any of the groups with interest in education. And I believe some of them are here today as well to offer testimony. And I will note that we are going to limit any presenter to no more than 5 minutes. And just to keep it fair, if you're less than 5 minutes, that's completely fine. But at 5 minutes, we will make a hard stop just to be fair to everyone who will be presenting. So I'll go ahead and call down folks that I believe are here today and prepared to offer comments on their priorities or whatever they would like to share with the committee here as we kick off the new legislature. Association of Metropolitan School Districts, Minnesota School Board Association, Schools for Equity in Education. We'll start with those three, and please come on down to the testifier table. All right, and whenever you're ready, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and I do have copies of our platform of the page.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. AMSD is an association of 46 metropolitan area school districts, and those districts enroll just about one half of the public school students in the state of Minnesota. And greatly appreciate the chance to just share a few highlights from our 2015 legislative platform, which is being distributed. Our board just approved this last month, and as you will soon see as you get a chance to look at it, it's very comprehensive. And pretty ambitious, and we recognize that, and we realize that we're not going to have probably available funding to do everything on it, but these are the issues that rose to the top for our members. The platform is really organized around four key components: funding, facilities, local control and mandate reduction, and world's best workforce support. in the area of funding, and I think you'll probably hear this as a theme, the basic formula is the top priority, as it is pretty much every funding year. Our board is advocating for a 4% per year formula increase, but no matter what level increase you're able to afford, one thing we would really ask you to look at would be to indexing the formula to inflation going forward into the future. It would really help with stability for your local school districts. It's very difficult. Right now, they're basically assuming, you know, that the formula will be flat, because that's what current law calls for. And I'm already starting to get phone calls from business managers just asking me to, what's my opinion? What do I think the formula might increase? And that's obviously quite a difficult position. And I don't really like to make those kind of predictions because those are major million-dollar decisions for school districts. So
that's wise advice.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Madam Chair. The second item on our funding platform is allowing your locally elected school boards to renew an existing referendum. This has been discussed over the last several years, and I would emphasize that this the request is just to renew an existing referendum, so it would not be an increase. Those would still need to be to go to the voters, but our contention here is that we spend in an incredible amount of time each year in school districts across the state conducting elections, and oftentimes it's just for a district to renew what they're already receiving. And the success rate for renewal elections is almost 100%. So really we're spending tens of thousands of dollars, taxpayer dollars by the way, on these elections, not to mention the time and energy. And again, just for so school districts can hang on to what they already have. You talked already previously about special education, and Mr. Strom and Ms. Johnson provided some great information there. Our platform is calling for funding the state special education formula. We understand that the federal government is not living up to its obligations, but our focus here, of course, at the state level is just to fund the state formula. And then the recently adopted local optional revenue, which really was passed in 2013 as location equity revenue and was, by the way, a House initiative that the House of Representatives really carried forward, was originally adopted to recognize regional cost differences, and that was a recommendation coming out of the Commissioner's Task Force on School Finance Reform. And so we would ask you to look at actually going back and putting an index of some sort into that program so it actually did recognize those regional cost differences. You just had a great presentation on facilities, and our board fully supports the recommendations that came out of that facilities task force. We have quite an uneven playing field right now, and even though I represent most of the school districts that actually do qualify for that alternative facilities program, they will be the first to agree that all school districts should have access to that. It's a great program. It's one that actually saves taxpayer money in the long run because you take care of those deferred maintenance issues up front and don't let those buildings further deteriorate. And it's just a great program that we really should move forward with. I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through the local control section other than to say we just hope that we'll refrain this session from any new unfunded mandates, and whatever progress we can make on funding those that are already on the books would be great. I'll just point out one quick example there is in the compensatory formula area. We think that would be an area that's ripe for really some reform and greater flexibility. Current law calls for the vast majority of compensatory funding to be spent at the site level, and we think a little more flexibility there would be great. And then just to end, I won't spend any time, but the world's best workforce legislation passed, great goals set out, and we just highlighted some areas of support that would be helpful in implementing that. Right. So thank you, Madam Chair and members. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Grimcrest. We appreciate it. All right, Ms. Kelleher, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chairman and members, it's a pleasure to be in front of you again. Oh. It was like a pass. I had it up there and it wasn't ready. It's a pleasure to be in front of you again this year, and it is wonderful to see so many familiar faces and school board members around the table. MSBA is a little bit different from a lot of the organizations you'll see coming up here. We have a legislative unit, but we also have many other association pieces we provide to school districts. We've been around since 1920. We're the eighth oldest school district in the nation, and we have 100% of school districts who participate in our organization. So we're pretty proud of that. We oftentimes provide policy services, or anything anytime is required for policy. We've got a book that's about this big with policies local boards can adopt so they don't have to employ attorneys to write individual policies on issues that might come in front of them. We have a leadership conference, which is going on right now in Minneapolis, where we have a two-day workshop and seminars for board members to continue to get training, but also to look in what innovation is happening around the state. We have summer seminars. We analyze continuing contracts of teachers and other staff. We supply superintendent search services, and we have in-service training for board members around the state. So that's a piece you won't always see in front of it. I'm here doing the lobbying piece along with Denise Dietrich and Snezhana Bezanov. We'll also have somebody sort of new on the team. Mr. Deans, as you know, sort of retired from the legislature after about 25 years here. And we're going to see Peter Martin, who's from that same firm. He specializes in special education law. So you'll find him with us on and off as we get closer to bill deadline, hoping to provide some more clarity from a legal and case law point of view for the association. I just want to give you a brief idea of what we do in the lobbying end. We provide this session wrap-up to our members at the end of every session, where we go through and look at all the law, not only the law passed in education finance, but other places in the state that might impact school districts. We provide them that service. And we also have a really active grassroots organization which helps adopt our legislative policy. They start really with individual ideas board members have from around the state, and they send it in. Denise and I spend about 2 months writing background for our members to consider as they come together in December with their legislative platform. And I brought a book from this year so you get an idea of what it looks like both sides. So it's comprehensive. 150 regionally elected board members then vote on what policies they want to see included in our legislative platform. So with that, I'll just give you a quick look. I just handed out. You'll hear us talking about a lot for standing up for public school students and a lot of our members from around the state who have happily shared their pictures and their feelings on that. We would like to see some additional money on the formula, especially as you look at inflation. Anoka Hennepin brought this idea to us that we really need to stand back and look at electricity costing more, facilities costing more. How do school districts handle those increasing costs without continually feeling like we're whining for additional dollars? So we'd like you to consider those just facts of life districts face going forward. We'd like to have some flexibility to recruit and hire teachers. In this resolution book I just showed you, we had rather a first-time event. We had a resolution that was passed by the Minneapolis School Board and the Thief River School Board, which basically said we need more teachers. And that is a piece we'll pursue, hopefully looking at teacher loan forgiveness programs. But Thief River Falls had 4 open elementary places at the end of December, which if you've been on a board at all, you can understand it. Minneapolis also has a need for great teachers and teachers of color going forward. We've never been very good at that. They came together with the resolution. It passed, I think, with only 4 people voting against it. But it's really something we need to talk about, and that may even look like some kind of teacher reciprocity. We're losing a huge amount of teachers to North Dakota, basically because if you graduate with a degree in education, you can teach in North Dakota. And a lot of our folks say 3 tests is too much and too chancy and too expensive, so I'm going to go. So I really ask you to help us figure out how to retain teachers and get more teachers into our system, because we basically don't work if we don't have teachers.
All right, Ms. Keller, there's 5, so if you want to wrap up.
I'll be fast.
Thank you.
Technology, we'd like you to take a peek at. We'd also like you to look at post-secondary and how our interlink between K-12 and post-secondary is. And we'd like an opportunity to also talk about school trust land with you. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and I promise you that we will have that discussion. So thank you.
Appreciate it.
All right. Mr. Lindell.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lindell with Schools for Equity and Education. For those of you not familiar with the organization, we're a consortium of 58 school districts located throughout the state of Minnesota, both metro and non-metro. The basis of the organization coming together, or the group that came together, was the low property wealth and how the low property wealth affects referendum, debt service levies, and other school levies that are in place. Of all the organizations in the school area, or the school finance area, we're the one that probably lives the closest in this union of the property tax and tax system and the education funding system. And we certainly work to make sure that the taxpayer, the property taxpayer's needs are kept in mind as property tax, property wealth differences are calculated in these formulas. Just briefly on our platform, and this is certainly an abbreviated list, we'll certainly be talking about many things that are coming before the legislature, and don't always feel free to contact me if you see a bill or have a question about something that's going on and where we can put our feedback into the loop. The Facilities Task Force, as been pointed out by both Mr. Kroonquist and Ms. Kelleher, is something that we're very, 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 very important to us. We're looking this year probably again, as Schools for Equity says, equity is often looks at the difference between school districts and how districts with limited resources and limited ability to do certain things to narrow that gap between the high expenditure districts and or high revenue districts and then the districts at the lower end of the spectrum. We think that what has come forward from that facilities task force is very, very good work. Again, there is a lot of equalization in there, the debt service program, and also an expansion of the alternative facilities that, again, and we'll be seeing a lot of those bills coming through, and we'll certainly want to put in our oar in the water on that. One thing that we're looking at this year more closely is in that second set of bullets is to look at, again, the categorical differences. We're not looking to take money from any district, but we're trying to get back to districts that I believe that have not concentrations of free and reduced price lunch students, but do have a great number of free and reduced price lunch students, and trying to get that kind of that boat to rise a little bit. We're also interested in career and technical education. The special education funding is something, again, that we're, as been pointed out here several times today, something that's a real problem for districts to deal with. We're also always going to be in on the general education formula and the basic formula going up. If you look at districts throughout the state, the general education formula, basic formula, comprises a larger percentage of our general funds than it does for any other type of district in the state. We're kind of balancing those needs of the general education basic amount and then trying to look for some ways to take those districts that are at or near the bottom of the list. And I've on the CU website, I've got them classified many different ways, as you can see where districts rank in that zero to first to 330-something in various funding categories. And certainly, if you need more information on that, I'll be glad to come forward with it. We had a lot of success in 2013 with the equalization factor for the referendum going up. We'll be monitoring that this year. It was a great step forward in 2013 and 2014 with the local option revenue. We want to make sure, again, that we look at that and keep an eye on that, but certainly looking at some of the other formulas that aren't equalized or the levies that aren't equalized to the extent that they were. Again, the debt service has sat for about 20 years without those equalizing factors being upgraded, and certainly something that we want to look at. Again, though, we think that the work between the tax committee and this committee needs to be monitored. It's very difficult to call that education funding when it's really dollars going to property tax relief. And certainly balancing those targets between what's happening here in Representative Drazkowski's division and then also in the tax committee is something that we really want to make sure that coordination is there, because we want money on the formula, but we also think that needs to be delivered in a way that's tax friendly. And that oftentimes requires input from the tax committee. So with that, I'll stand for any questions. Look forward to meeting all of you. I know that there are a number of you I've worked with in the past and represent C districts, and I look forward to continuing that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lindell. Appreciate it. All right. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, as people come before us and tell us how many school districts they're representing and what they are doing for their school districts, I would appreciate knowing what is the membership cost for the school district to belong to the organization that they're representing.
Very well, Representative Murphy. We will ask the testifiers to provide that. In fact, if the first three testifiers, if you have that information and want to come down and provide it to the committee, feel free if you want to submit that to the committee at a later time. All right, Ms. Kelleher, if you want to come down, if you've got that information with you.
Madam Chairman and members, Representative Murphy, I don't have the exact dollar amount, but MSBA bases the number. We have a set amount, and then it's based on pupils, and I would be happy to provide that information for all the districts. But it's most of them, because most smaller districts, I want to say like $5,000. It's not a tremendous huge amount, but I will give you every individual district and what they pay in dues. So that's not a problem. So thank you, and that's the best I can give you, Mayor.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Kronquist.
Yes, Madam Chair and members. We have a tiered dues structure, so the larger enrollment districts pay more than the smaller enrollment districts, and so it would range from roughly $7,000 to $14,000. And again, I could get exact figures for as well, but that's a ballpark range.
All right. And Mr. Lindell.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, like Mr. Kronquist's organization, we have a tiered membership. We have approximately half is based on kind of the base services, and then half is based on enrollment of each district, because we've got some smaller districts where everybody's consuming the same product, so we charge the same for that. But then we figure bigger districts are getting, because they're bigger, they do pay a little bit more. Again, like Ms. Kelleher, I can give you the amount of every district in C.
All right, thank you. And Representative Quam, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Since we're getting it for the associations where the small districts try to band together for that, can we also get from the large school districts what they spend in their budget for lobbying themselves? Because I do know several of the large districts hire individual lobbyists on their own.
All right, fair enough. We will ask that of all the testifiers and the districts and their representatives. All right. Next up, I have the Minnesota Business Partnership and then the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
Hello, Madam Chair, members.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Jim Bartholomew. I'm with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and thank you for the time to talk with you today. Our summary of recommendations, I believe, was handed out earlier. It looks like this, but I'll spare you the time of going through all 10 recommendations and just hit a few. Briefly, our members are the leaders of Minnesota's larger employers, employing over 400,000 Minnesotans and 2 million people worldwide. Education has always been a top priority for our members, because Minnesota's ability to thrive in a global environment is dependent on the quality